Welcome to the Insightful Investor Podcast, a weekly series that seeks to share industry, investment, and market insights. We define insights as concepts that are counterintuitive, widely misunderstood, or underappreciated. In other words, unique ideas that you probably won't hear elsewhere. I'm Alex Shahidi, the host of the podcast and co-CIO of Evoke Advisors, one of the nation's leading investment advisory firms. Learn more about our show at insightfulinvestor.org. Today's guest is Hal Hirschfield. Hal is a professor of marketing, behavioral decision-making, and psychology at UCLA's Anderson School of Management. He's also the author of Your Future Self, How to Make Tomorrow Better Today. Hal, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks, Alex. I'm excited to be here.
Well, I'm really excited about this conversation because it is relatively different from the other weekly guests that I have on this podcast. The way I think about it is, you know, I'm a financial advisor. I try to help people make well-informed financial decisions. And over time, I've learned that there's really two steps in that decision-making process. The first step is understanding what you should do, thinking about the prudent decisions. And the second step in practice is to actually make those decisions. And as we know, people often make decisions based on emotion, and they have certain biases. And you know, as a financial advisor, I'm not a psychology PhD, you know, like you are. And you've devoted your career to not only understanding how people think, but also, and perhaps more importantly, trying to figure out how to help them make the decisions that they ultimately want to make, but they have a hard time making. So I'm really excited to dive into some of these topics today.
Yeah, same here.
Okay, so why don't we just kick it off with your background? You teach at UCLA's School of Management, but your background is in psychology. You got a PhD from Stanford in psychology.
Yeah.
What originally sparked that interest, and did you ever dream to be a psychologist?
Yeah, no. I should be really clear that I did not ever dream to be a psychologist. both of my parents are psychologists, and my wife is too. But then, of course, you know, I ended up doing a psych PhD, which, you know, sometimes your fate, you can't escape it, right? Okay, but I, not to get too into the weeds, but, you know, I did a PhD in research, you know, experimental psychology, right? So I can't help anybody with their with their problems. You know, when I went to grad school, my mentor there is Laura Carstensen, and she is an expert in decision making. Especially decision-making over time, decision-making as we age. And, you know, I didn't anticipate this, but when I got to grad school, one of the things that I started studying was decisions that surround retirement. Now, Laura, my advisor, is very focused on policy-relevant decision-making. And I didn't realize that I had that interest, but I did. And so I thought, oh, I'll be a professor in a psych department, or I'll do some research or something like that. But what I ended up doing is research that kind of like squarely situates me in a business school context, because this is where we look at sort of, you know, theoretically interesting, but applied work.
Got it. And you can actually make a pretty significant difference in people's lives.
That's the hope, you know? I mean, it really is. And I think there's more and more business school professors, economists and psychologists and whatnot who, you know, use research findings to then change policy and change decision-making context for industry and companies to then help people do more of the things that they say that they want to do. To sort of like you said, you started with that point of like knowing the things I want to do and then doing them and sort of closing that gap there.
You wrote a book called Your Future Self, How to Make Tomorrow Better Today. Would you tell us about the book and your key findings?
Yeah, for sure. The book really starts with this perspective of, you know, or really starts with the question of why do so many people have a hard time doing the things that they say that they want to do? You know, so I say I want to save more, but I often overspend. Or it's not just money, right? You know, I say I want to eat healthy, but then I snack at night, or I say I want to exercise more, or, you know, time. Like I say I want to spend more time on the things that are important to me, but then I find myself answering my, you know, 100th urgent but not important email. Right. And suddenly the day's gone. Right. So the book really looks at the reasons why we have these gaps and starts from this perspective of trying to understand the relationships that we have with our future selves, recognizing that sometimes those relationships are fraught, that we don't really connect to the people that we will eventually become. And then, you know, so much of the book is spent looking at solutions. How do we connect more to our future selves so that we can do more of the things that we say that we want to do? That's just a little teaser, you know, of the book. It's best, you know, if you really want to digest it, it's best to get like 4 or 5 copies of it, you know, and give to other. That's a joke. Sorry.
That's 4 to 5 copies per listener to the podcast.
Per listener, exactly.
Sounds good. And is it, just to add to the teaser, is sort of the notion that, you know, you care about others and you can see them and you want to do things that, you know, better their lives. But you may not necessarily do that for yourself because you can't see your future self. But if you could, maybe with AI, you can, you know, if you can see your future self, maybe you're emotionally connected more closely.
So, you know, I think it's a big part of it, right? I'll go a step further and say, there's a lot of other people in our lives who we make decisions on behalf of. And those people range from folks we're barely connected to people that we're very connected to, emotionally speaking. And there are times, many times where we say no. And, you know, it may not be a conscious no, but we walk by people and help. We don't respond to requests from our money or our time, because we have only so much money and time that we can give to others. But there's a lot of other people and organizations and groups where we do say yes. And those are the ones that we feel a sense of connection to. And so you translate that to our future selves. And the point is that there may be cases in which we don't really feel a sense of connection to our future selves. It's easy to ignore them. We don't see them, but it's not just that we don't see them. We don't feel their feelings. Or we don't really take the time to feel their feelings. And then it's easy to say, oh, you know, yeah, I'm going to sleep in today rather than work out. Or I'm going to, you know, eat the thing my doctor said I probably should stay away from, but it tastes so good right now, you know? But when we can try to create those relationships that are, you know, high on empathy, that are representative of a strong emotional connection, that's when we'll start doing more things for our future selves, the things that will benefit us later, but not just later, also benefit us now, right? And I think this is one of the misconceptions that everything always has to be a trade-off over time. There are plenty of times where I can do something that will benefit me in the long run, and it benefits me now too.
Yeah, part of what you said is very counterintuitive in that we're, in many cases, less connected to our future selves than we are other people. And it's yourself. So yeah, you would think you'd be pretty well connected. Right. But there's something about that time gap that separates you from yourself.
No, it's exactly right. I mean, I think it's a really, I love the way that you put that, because I think it highlights the fact that, you know, even though it is, I'll call it a version of ourselves, right? Because, you know, it is future me. It's still in essence me. And so then to say, well, I may rather do something for somebody else right now, it does feel counterintuitive. But then when you start saying, well, if my future self is just like any other person, you know, and there's a spectrum of other people right now, some of whom I help and some of whom I don't, if that future self kind of falls toward the end of the people I don't know, people I don't care about, I know they exist, but I don't really like feel their feelings. Well, then maybe it does make sense that I don't do much for him.
Right. And maybe you've already checked off the box for myself and you haven't divided it up into two people.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, I love that. That's great.
So let's dive into some behavioral biases that people yeah. have. What are some of the ones that you've studied, either relating to finance or in investing or not?
So, you know, there's a lot, I'll say a couple of things. So maybe let's, you know, note that I think it's kind of like, it's like hot right now to talk about biases, right? And of course, you know, we can't talk about this without mentioning that Daniel Kahneman just passed away. Daniel Kahneman, I'm sure many of your listeners know, but if they don't, right, he's kind of the, you know, considered, you know, one of the co-founders, if you will, of behavioral economics. And a lot of, and he's a psychologist, and a lot of what he and Tversky and others have studied are these quote unquote biases. But biases, you know, I think it leads us to think about these things in not quite the right light. There are a lot of tendencies that we have that serve a purpose. But then when they're over-applied, they can become a quote-unquote bias, right? So, you know, the one that I've spent so much of my time on is, you know, known as temporal discounting. That's a fancy term for basically saying that we often choose the thing now over the thing later. Now, here's where it's not a bias. If I were to say to you, hey, Alex, you want $100 now, or do you want to wait 6 weeks and get $100? I can't imagine why you would tell me you would wait. It's the same amount of money.
Right.
From a financial perspective, you could invest that money right now and make more, right? But now if I say, okay, wait, you want $100 now or $150 in 6 weeks? And if you still choose the $100 now, now we're starting to see that your tendency to choose now over later may have been over applied. Because, I mean, a 50% return in 6 weeks is
right.
That's pretty good, right?
Right.
So that's a bias that I've studied quite a bit, is the tendency to excessively discount future rewards in favor of the present day ones that we, you know, the things that I can get right now.
And why do you think that is? And is there anything we can do about it? Or is it wrong? Or do we need to do something about it?
Yeah, no, that I think that's a really smart question. And it's, you know, I'll answer you, but I think it's really smart to ask the question you're asking, which is that, like, just because something looks like a bias doesn't always mean that we need to be doing something about it, right? There's enough things to be doing something about. Part of the reason, look, that we engage in this sort of behavior is that the present is more certain than the future is, of course. You know, part of the reason is that the present feels more emotional. Like, everything that's happening right now feels more intense than the way that we anticipate the same things happening will be in the future, or even the same things in the past. Okay, now what do you do about it? I mean, there's a variety of different techniques. You know, one of the things I love is it's almost like a framing intervention. Basically, you know, if I were to ask, you know, I asked you that question, do you want $100 now or 150 in 6 weeks? There's two hidden things there. And what they are is this. I could say it a different way. I could say, do you want $100 now and $0 in 6 weeks? Or do you want $150 in 6 weeks and $0 now? Researchers call that the hidden zero. And it turns out when you ask people that way, when you sort of fully flesh out the options to them, they're more likely to be patient. Because now it's like you're really fully spelling out, you're getting something later, but you're not getting something now, or you're getting something now and you're not getting something later. I love that as a really simple tool, especially with, you know, so many of our decisions about now and later. So look, that's just one bias. That's one bias that I've studied. Another bias that I love thinking about is, it's known as the availability bias. So if I were to ask you, Alex, what do you think that's more common, blue cars or orange cars? What would you say?
Probably blue.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Now let me ask you, do you think there were more deaths related to selfie sticks or deaths related to climbing Mount Everest?
Most people would say two, but I'm going to say one because you wouldn't have asked the question.
Okay. You gamed it there. That's right. All right. Now the reality is, you're right. Most people would say two.
More people who use selfie sticks than climb the mountain.
Yeah. I mean, you can do the ratios. Right. So here's the thing. You were right the first time. Blue cars more common than orange cars. I'm going to guess you'd answer that quickly. You didn't like consult the DMV or
correct
AI or whatever. You just figured it out. The reason you figured that out, the way that you figured that out, I'm guessing, is that you did a really quick scan of your sort of memory to say, okay, I've been driving recently. What do I have seen more? You've seen more blue cars and orange cars. And you said, let me take what's available and use that availability of data and project it into the future. And you were right. So that's not a bias. That's a heuristic. That's a shortcut that you used, right? But now when I asked about the selfie sticks and the Mount Everest deaths, well, you messed up my demonstration a little bit, but we're going to move beyond that.
I've never seen either one, so I had to go to something else.
So, you know, it turns out in the last 10 years, there have actually been more deaths related to selfie sticks than there have been deaths related to climbing Mount Everest. Now, we don't have to go into the numbers there, but you might think it would be Mount Everest because we hear more about Mount Everest. We hear more about climbing deaths. They're dramatic and they're scary. And oftentimes the selfie stick one is like a accident, and, you know, they're all accidents, but it doesn't get reported as much. If you had the tendency, though, to say, well, it must be Mount Everest, then you're again using the availability heuristic. but you're over applying it to the point that it becomes a bias. So I think this is super interesting because this is one that has direct implications for investing, right? So much of investments that rely on, you know, herd mentality or this experience of like, I don't want to miss out is all related to availability. Because I see everyone else getting rich, or seemingly I see everybody else getting rich off of the flavor of the day investment strategy. And I say, oh, it's going to be that way forever. I better get in. And by the time I've heard about it, it's probably a little too late.
Right. And I guess that's related to recency bias. Is that similar?
Yes. 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 Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the two are cousins in a way, right? But they go hand in hand.
That's right. You mentioned fear of missing out, FOMO. There's another fear, and that's fear of loss. And I guess that could theoretically be a healthy fear, because if we didn't have the fear of loss, maybe we'd be extinct by now.
Yeah. Well, and I think that again comes back to this perspective that, you know, these things are not all entirely irrational, right? So, you know, loss aversion makes sense in a way, right? Like if you think about from an evolutionary standpoint, it may make sense for me to not know what the future holds, and I better take a sure gain over a potential loss here, even though the expected value could be higher. But then, you know, loss aversion, and I should sort of clarify that there's been, you know, I can define it really quickly. Loss aversion is the basic idea that because losses hurt more than gains feel good, right? Because losses feel worse than gains feel good, we go out of our way to avoid them. And there's some debate about, you know, the extent to which that plays out and the magnitude of it. But I think the sort of general conclusion is that it's a pretty strong, pervasive sense that we, that many of us experience. Right. And so, well, I'm curious from you, you know, I'd love to hear from you. Where do you see it playing out, especially with clients?
When their portfolio goes down, and some clients have a smaller threshold
Totally.
So, you know, they lose a dollar and you're like, oh my God, I lost money, because it's the difference between not losing and losing. And some, you know, have more, have a bigger threshold. But at some point you hit the level that becomes uncomfortable, and then you start extrapolating the recent past into the distant future. And you think about the pain and you think about how hard this money was to earn. And then it's, you have some emotional response, but everybody has a breaking point.
Right. No, that's exactly right. And then, you know, what I'm curious about is when does that then lead to quote unquote irrational behavior?
Yeah. And that's such an interesting topic, because it's only irrational in hindsight. Meaning, let's say, you know, the portfolio goes down 5% and they just freak out and they say, I'm out. And then you look back and it would have gone down 50% had they done nothing. Then was it irrational or not? I'm not sure. You know, but yeah. If that was the lows and you look back and say that was irrational, you know, so in the moment, it's hard to know whether it's irrational or not. You know, that's the part that I have a hard time squaring.
It is hard to square. I mean, you know, I know that, you know, one of the common pieces of advice is to set these rules in advance, right? So that you're not making a decision based on, it may still be emotional when you set the decision in advance. In other words, if I said to you, listen, I want to get out if I drop below 5%. All right, well, there's a threshold there and you set it. Now, later, like you said, I could regret it or it could have been the right decision. But at least I would have made that decision with some well-informed, you know, reasoning. Mm-hmm. That's not just solely based on the feeling that I have at that particular moment, right? But like you said, it's tricky. It's tricky to you know, get that right.
That's right. And I think of it as we're trying to minimize negative surprises. So when you have a portfolio, there's some expectation of what the wiggles are going to look like through time. And when those occur, then if you react negatively, then I don't know if it's irrational, but you didn't do what you said you were going to do, right? Which is kind of goes back to our first point. So I think that's where I connect the two, is what happened versus what you should have expected would happen. And did you act irrationally in the heat of the moment relative to what you said you were going to do earlier. And then sometimes you get things that happen that you don't expect, and then that's a different conversation.
Right. No, exactly. And I think nobody's saying that the solution to any of these biases is to have a crystal ball, right?
Right.
But you deal with what you do what you can with what you know.
That's right. And then I think we all, you know, I learn about the clients through time. They learn about themselves. Sometimes you don't know what your threshold is until you get really close to it. Right. And that adds another level of complexity because you only get so many rounds.
Right.
And it's right. Not like you can read in a book or hear stories from others. That complicates that. So to me, a long-term relationship with a client is largely about educating them to understand the decisions they should make, and then both of you learning about them over time and figuring out what is the right, you know, mix that is appropriate for you.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, it's interesting because this is the type of question or the type of This is the type of decision-making context that I deal with a lot, both in my research and my teaching, and then, you know, when I do consulting, which is that if I want to help somebody help themselves, and when I say, you know, like, because they say, I want to act a certain way, I don't want to invest in this way, I want to invest in that way, but then I'm, you know, I can't do it. There's the strategy of education, right? There's the strategy of giving them sort of, you know, messages, and then there's this of you know, encouragement and motivation and whatnot. And then there's a strategy of changing the decision-making environment to make it harder to screw things up, right? So I just came across this great example here in my faculty building here at UCLA. We have this little coffee lounge for the faculty. It's not that fancy. We get all the old MBA student furniture. And we've had some like security breaches recently. And so we got all these emails saying, make sure you close the doors to the faculty lounge so there's not a security breach. So there's the education, right? And then I noticed that there started to be signs that were put up of saying, please close this door, you know, like make sure this door is closed for security reasons. So that's the kind of motivational messages. And then a couple of days I went in there and I noticed that they took the door handle off. The door that goes to the outside. Now I can't exit that door, you know, that would have gotten me outside. And I think that's a perfect representation of the different sort of levels of severity that we can implement, both with ourselves and with clients or any sort of person who's we're making a decision on behalf of or helping make a decision. And it's not that one is better than the other, but they all entail different levels of severity.
One of the topics that you've discussed is this notion of creating a connection between your present self and your future self and bringing the two closer to together to help you make decisions for yourself in the future. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so this is, you know, at the heart of a lot of my work. One of the things that we've done is trying to measure how do people feel connected to their future selves? And there's a variety of ways you can do it. And one of the things we found is that the people who feel more of this sense of emotional connection to their future selves are more likely to have done things like accrued assets or have higher financial well-being or, you know, report exercising, these sorts of things. And then, you know, we've also tried to get people to feel more of a sense of connection to their future selves. One of the strategies I really like is a letter writing exercise, a conversation, get people to sort of like converse with their future selves, write a letter to that future self, and then pretend to be that future self and write a letter back, which now, you know, you can do, you don't need.
You can probably text yourself, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Actually, there's a great website, Dear Future Me, where you can write an email and it gets sent back to you at some later point in time. But it's a nice strategy because it you know, it's some work, right? It's like anything else in the behavior change space. It requires some level of commitment and engagement. But I think one of the things that it does is it forces you to step out of time, to step out of the right now and the present and see the sort of connections between now and later.
Yeah. And in some ways you're opening up the lines of communication.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, one of the things that I spend a lot of time doing, and a lot of the guests do this as well, is, and I found the ones that tend to be the most insightful have this ability, pretty remarkable ability, to zoom out and see things from further away And when you look at it from that perspective, there are certain things that are very obvious and certain mistakes people make that are very obvious. But when you're in the middle of it, you don't see it. And they have a very good way to articulate that. And I think what you're talking about is similar in that if you can kind of zoom out and see yourself, you know, in terms of zooming out in terms of time as opposed to distance, you can probably gain some insight and some connection to yourself.
I think you said that so well. And there's, you know, there's the like bird's eye view that we can apply, right? It allows us, you know, I think one of the things that it allows us to do is to recognize that every decision we make is part of the other decisions we make. You know, I one of the things I've noticed in my work and my observations is that people are really good at making exceptions out of the present. So I can take anything I do and convince myself that it's this is the exception, right? So, you know, I can
this time is different.
This time is different, right? I know I should work out tonight, but it's so nice outside. You know, it'd be a lot nicer to just sit outside and have a glass of wine or something like that, right? But if I do that every time it's nice outside, it's not just a one-time exception. It becomes my norm, right? And so I think the stepping out of time, the seeing the you know, the 30,000 foot view, if you will, what it allows you to do is see how all these decisions we make connect together and that you add them up over time. They result in something different than if I don't make decision A, B, or C.
Right. You know, good outcomes come from a series of good decisions. Some of those are small decisions. Some of them are big decisions. Most of them are small decisions. But if you just follow the decision tree and you go to the left branch instead of the right branch, and then you go to left branch again and again and again and again, you end up in a completely different place.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. And I think the hardest part is recognizing, you know, those biases and those tendencies to make those decisions, and then also understanding and appreciating the long-term impact. And if you have the ability to zoom out and see yourself in the future, or even just see the future a little bit better, more clearly, more vividly, then you're more likely to sympathize, right? And empathize with, okay, this is the impact, you know, the short-term decisions. Well, one of the, and maybe it's possible now, and maybe there's apps that do this, and you and I talked about this before, but I thought if you could take somebody and they look on their phone and they can see what they look like, physically look like in 5 years based on their daily habits today.
Right.
And then if they change, you know, say, and you can say, look, if I work out today and this is my habit, then in 5 years is what I look like. And if I don't today, this is what I look like in 5 years, because today is going to, you know, there's a correlation between what I do today and tomorrow and so on. Then you can see the impact, the long-term impact, but I can see it today and it's vivid and it's in front of me. That would probably change behavior.
Yeah, no, it's great. You know, it's funny. I'm reminded, you know, ages ago, I had this idea with one of my collaborators, Dan Goldstein, who's at Microsoft Research. And we said, okay, along these lines, I mean, this is probably 10 years ago now that we did this. We worked with computer scientists who had figured out like the minimal number of pieces of data that you need to be able to show someone a silhouette of what they look like. So like, it's crazy. It turns out if I just get a couple pieces of info from you, I can draw a pretty good silhouette of your body. And so we did this crazy, almost sci-fi study where we mailed all of these Wi-Fi enabled scales, you know, which is not that revolutionary, but 10 years ago it was, to hundreds of people. And we got their little silhouettes. And then every time they would step on the scale, we would like beam back to them these projected images. And what we failed to consider, and this is where like I do a lot of work that's, you know, interdisciplinary. What I really needed was somebody, I needed like a health psychologist on this, because what I failed to consider is that there's all these different fluctuations in our weight that have nothing to do with whether we eat healthy or worked out. And so like all these people were like, one day my projection is I look like this svelte fit guy. And then the next day I'm like this balloon. And so, you know, obviously what we needed in retrospect is sort of a moving average of like, here's your patterns. Like you said, put all that data together and then let me project out what you look like. And you can imagine all different ways to execute that. Right. But I love that. I think it'd be cool.
You know, in the financial world, what we have a tendency to do as professionals is to show charts and data. And yeah, the, you know, the whole notion of compound interest. And if you do, and to us, because we live in that world, that is vivid and it is, it changes behavior. But to just about everybody else, they look at that and it just falls flat and has no impact.
Yeah. I always, you know, it's funny. I talk about this because it's one of the things we know is that if you want to move behavior, you got to get someone to feel something. Like we talked about emotions earlier as, you know, maybe sometimes we don't want to necessarily rely on our emotions in these hot moments, the, you know, loss aversion and FOMO and whatnot. But then in other times, we do want to get our emotions kicked into gear to do more of the thing that we say we want to do. Now, what's emotional? Vivid, right? Like things that are vivid are emotional. And like you said, that compound interest chart, anybody in the industry that I talk to is like, this thing is like magic. I mean, if you think about it, it's magic, right? And then, but then you show it to a client who doesn't think in these terms and they're like, all right, that line is going up fast. That's not as emotional as me showing you what you'll look like or how you'll, your world will be perceived or seem based on the decisions you're making now.
Right. This is why commercials work, right? This is why charities show you the people that you're impacting and the change in their lives that, that you can have an influence in and so on.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. And I guess in our industry, there's much less of that. And I think it's because we don't have enough psychology PhDs as financial advisors.
It could be.
You've also spent some time and emphasis on time allocation. Would you talk to us about that?
Yeah. I mean, so I have some work. This is work done with my collaborator, Cassie Holmes. I looked up because her office is upstairs, but I don't think that means anything to anybody. You know, one of the things that we've looked at is the amount of discretionary time that people have and how that relates back to well-being. You know, on some level, so much of what we've talked about already is about these decisions about how I want my life to look. Like, am I spending more now or saving more later? What, you know, what does it look like? And then time is another one of these trade-off type resources. I hinted at this earlier, but this decision about, you know, do I spend it more on the urgent things or the important things? Or broadly, you know, step back. Do I spend more time working now so I have more time to relax later? And so, you know, I know it's not so black and white, but that's the type of decision. We had ages ago, we had run this study where we had asked people if they wanted more time or more money. Like it was kind of a hypothetical, but we just wanted to see what people would say. It shouldn't be shocking. You know, most people say they want more money than more time. But then when you look at the, you know, about a third of people who say they want more time, they're happier. And it's, you know, there's a million things you can control for. I'm not going to get into the weeds here, but we do a lot of careful work to say, okay, it's not just that people who want money are more materialistic or they're less wealthy or whatever it is. You account for all these different things. And the people who want more time tend to be the ones who are doing better because they know how to spend their time. That's the key answer. So then we started thinking about this a little more deeply. And one of the questions we realized that was unanswered was, well, what's the right amount of time, so to speak, to have? Right? You know, we all have 24 hours in the day. Like no matter, you know, no amount of wealth gets you more hours, kind of in a way, like subjectively, I can get more people to do things, but a day is 24 hours. But then we started wondering, like, well, what's the right amount of time to have? And so we were able to get our hands on some like pretty intensive data sets that literally map out how people spend, you know, their days minute by minute. And we can look at things like, how much discretionary time do they have? How much time do they have to do the things that they want to do versus the things that they have to do? And how happy are they? And it was, the finding there was very interesting, which is that it's not a perfect one-to-one match. It's not that the more time I have, the happier I am. There's kind of this plateau where it's like the less time I have, I'm not doing that well. And if I get more and more time, I'm doing a little better. But then at a certain point, more time isn't going to necessarily breed more happiness. No. And at that point, in this particular data set, it was around 2 hours a day, around 2 hours of discretionary time. You got to think about all the other things, sleep and eating and feeding your kids and work and all that stuff, right? What was interesting, though, is if you look at how people spend their discretionary time. If you're someone who spends your discretionary time in social pursuits or in doing things that seem purposeful to you, that you deem purposeful, then it's the sky's the limit. The more time you have of that, the happier you are. Right? So I think the takeaway, the punchline of this is that it's not a simple thing that, you know, if you could just get more hours back in your day, you'd be happier. But rather it's how you spend those hours rather than how many hours you have. That's what leads to more well-being and happiness over time, right? I say this and it's like, I fully recognize how hard it is to then like make the effort to spend those extra hours doing the things that are deemed purposeful, that are social and whatnot. Because it's just like any other one of these trade-offs we're talking about. What's the easiest thing to do? The easiest thing to do is to pick up my phone and goof around a little bit. Or maybe put something mindless on. The harder thing to do is to step outside and call a friend or do something and, you know, take some action that feels a little bit more purposeful. But those are the things that matter and add up to mattering over time.
It's pretty fascinating. And you're right. We all have 24 hours, but we have the flexibility to prioritize as well to some limitation. And part of that prioritization, if you could optimize, if you're a computer, you do the things that give you the greatest utility, not just today, but over time, and you discount, you know, over time to today, and you'd probably be happy. But we don't do that, you know, as humans. We have these biases and tendencies and blind spots, and some, you know, are probably good and many are not. So it's pretty, that whole thing is just fascinating. And I don't know if there's a simple solution, but I guess being aware of it at least gives you some insight into, if I make this decision, it may benefit me today, but over time I lose. And you just knowing it may help, you know, tilt the odds in the favor of doing what's better for you long term.
Yeah. So, you know, actually, just as a plug, Cassie Holmes has a great book. It's called Happier Hour. Okay. And one of the things that she does is walk through exercises to try to like be more conscious of how to spend those extra hours, right? Because you're right, it is like knowing it, but then there's also, what are the things I can do? And, you know, one of the gaps that we have is not fully appreciating how we spend our time and how the ways we spend our time maps on our own happiness, right? And so one of the things that she suggests is like a time audit, where you almost look at, you know, you take a week and you sort of each day at the end of the day, write down, what did I do today and how happy was I doing it? And you start to realize, you know, oh, writing my 100th email wasn't.
Yeah, you see a couple of those things. Like if you hire a nutritionist, you have a food log, right?
Exactly.
And, you know, now on your iPhone, it tells you how many hours of screen time you have, you know, and it's better or it's worse than last week.
Yep.
It's part of the education process, right? You want to understand the impact of your decisions. And a lot of people don't think about it. And when you put it in front of you, and especially if it's compelling, and it's one of those things where you learn it and then you act on it and then you gain some utility.
Yeah.
And therefore, and you start building momentum, right? Is that just the general idea?
The nutritionist example is a great example because, again, it's sort of like highlights something we were talking about earlier, which is that it shows you a pattern where our tendency is to ignore it, right? And the same can be said for our time expenditures too. Like auditing that, logging our time can help us show us the patterns and the patterns that add up to doing things that don't make us that happy.
Right. If you try to succeed financially, I think of it as two steps. I always try to simplify these things. Step one is save, and then step two is invest wisely. Let's talk about savings. We've talked about that. That's a perfect example of delayed gratification. But I know you've done some studies where you've looked at different ways to save and maybe techniques to actually help lower the gap of, you know, difficulty to get there. Would you tell us about that?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that that I think is true about any of these delayed gratification contexts is that, you know, if you tease apart that concept of delayed gratification, it doesn't sound that exciting because I'm delaying something that's fun, right? Or gratifying or whatever. So who gets to suffer because of that? You know, it's me right now. Oh, sure. I've delayed gratification. Well, you know, that's about, you know, it doesn't sound like, that's not a great marketing pitch. Here's a great thing. Just don't do it now. One of the sort of principles that I've been trying to put into place with a lot of my research recently is to figure out the ways that we can dial down the pain that is felt in those contexts. Because again, it's the present self who has to suffer the sacrifice or, you know, experience the sacrifice. It's future self who gets to have the delayed gratification.
And that's always the case. The future self never gives up anything. It's an unfair, you know, compromise.
It's unfair. You know, it's like, it would be like being in a relationship where like, you're always the one that's doing everything for the other person. You'd get out of that if you were smart, right? That's not fun. So, okay, well, what can you do about it? Because you can't suddenly make future self sacrifice for present self without bending the the laws of time, right? So, you know, we've been trying to explore different ways. When I say we, some of my collaborators and I have been trying to explore different ways to make the pain feel less bad. So, you know, here's one thing we can do. We can frame savings in terms of smaller and smaller time amounts, right? So instead of saving $150 a month, I could save $5 a day. Well, you know, I fully admit that sounds pretty dumb. And it's ripped right out of the pages of like the mattress industry advertisements. You know, yeah, it's a $2,000 mattress, but it's only 6 cents a night for the best
sleeper. Probably works because you still see those ads.
You still see them because they do work. You know, we ran a study with a fintech app and found that four times as many people sign up for an automatic savings plan when it's framed as $5 a day compared to $150 a month because it feels less painful. Now, that's just one technique. Another thing that we've done is help, you know, it's not just dialing down the pain, but also helping people understand how their actions today, what that actually gets them later on, right? So one of the things we know is that lump sums may actually seem, subjectively, they may seem like more money than if you were to break them out into like an annuitized stream. Right. So we ran this study where we asked people, you know, how adequate does $100,000 seem for retirement? And then we said, well, to a different group and also to the same group, we varied things around, you know, how adequate does $500 a month seem, you know, or whatever the equivalent amount is. And we can talk about we don't have to. There's math behind this that we can, you know, you can consider, right? The funny thing is that people think that the lump sum seems more adequate. It seems like a bigger amount than if I break that amount down. Probably because we're not used to dealing with such large lump sums. We deal with those infrequently. Many people deal with those infrequently. And so then when we see one, we say, oh, it's pretty big. We're not thinking about like what that actually gets us.
Right. People aren't doing the mental math.
They're not doing the mental math. They're not doing that translation, right? Or if they are, they're doing it wrong. They're thinking $100,000 can buy me this, 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 and this. And before you know it, you're at $500,000, right? And one of the things that we've done is ask people how much they want to save, how motivated they are to save for the future, and show them a hypothetical retirement balance in the lump sum terms or in the sort of monthly broken out amount. And when it's broken down by month, then all of a sudden people say, oh, I think I want to save more. So I think there's an important lesson here, which is that we see the flip of this with any of these buy now, pay later schemes. You know, I buy a new TV and they say, well, you could buy it now or you could pay a certain amount over 12 months. Well, when it comes to spending, if we're trying to save more, the right idea is to probably aggregate the amount. Right. And say, okay, that TV, that's going to cost this amount in total. That may scare me away from it or get me to buy the slightly lower end model. When it comes to saving, it's probably better to disaggregate and to think about saving in terms of smaller and smaller amounts because that's easier to do. So I can add it up over time to ultimately create a larger amount for me. So, you know, but I think there's a bigger point here, which is that these are just a couple of the ways to think about, you know, framing the saving, spending decision. I think the point here is to consider, are there different ways to frame the same action to make it more likely that you'll follow through with it? By the way, if you come up with any other, you know, ideas, I'm happy to talk about some of the other ones, or like someone listening does, like tell them to me. I'm happy to test them.
Well, one that I just thought of as we're talking is the notion that the present self sacrifices everything and the future self sacrifices nothing. So it's an unfair relationship. And as I think about it, I think it's because the reference point may be incorrect. And what I mean by that is the future self is sacrificing everything for the present self. And it's only because it's the present self who's looking at it in some way selfishly and is thinking, why am I the one giving up? They're actually the one taking everything.
Yeah.
So the midpoint isn't the present. It's somewhere between the two extremes.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And all we're saying is get there. But yeah. You have to, and this is part of the zooming out. If you can see the world through your future self and you can see the world through your present self, you're more likely to meet in the middle, which is probably more optimal anyway.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That's great. I love that too, because you're right. Any decision I decide to do for right now is taking away something from my future self. That's right. That's great.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, it's almost the opposite, right?
Yeah.
A couple other biases that I've seen in my career is this idea of chasing returns. You know, one of the first rules of investing is buy low, sell high. And most people have a tendency to buy high and sell low. And that's basically looking backwards. You know, they talk about investing through their rearview mirror, but it's so prevalent and it's done by so many. And the commentary follows it. You know, when things are going up, there's more optimism. When things are going down, there's more pessimism, more fear, you know, and more FOMO going up. How do you think about that? And do you have any suggestions besides just being aware?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think this comes back again to this idea of stepping out, right? Because, you know, when you're chasing those returns, part of what you're doing is goes back to the recency bias, availability bias. I'm going to something that just happened. And I'm not sort of zooming out and looking at the big picture and what are the trends here and what are things that are like this particular pattern in the past and would now have been when I wanted to buy before, right? And so I do think that taking a minute to step back is the type of thing that's very helpful in these contexts to try to step away from these decisions. You know, the other thing I think is really useful to say is take the outside perspective. You know, what would I tell a friend doing this? Because it's a little easier to step away from the emotions that way. You know, would I advise my friend to get into this situation or would I tell them proceed with caution? And if I say proceed with caution, then I should apply the same advice to myself.
And I guess part of it is also thinking about these things in advance and maybe even writing it down or send yourself an email that gets triggered, you know, when the market goes up 20% and it gets sent to you and say, you know, the market's up 20% now. We talked about this before and, you know, you just got to be careful. You would have been better off buying it 20% before, not necessarily now. And also part of it is setting a plan and, you know, this is what we're going to do. We recognize that we have these emotions and maybe this one isn't healthy. So we're going to basically put in a trigger to remind myself, don't fall for this again.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That's right.
The other thing that I think is pretty unique in the investment world, and hopefully you can comment on this, is that time is very different here. You know, so 5 years is a relatively short period of time. That might just be one cycle, maybe even not a full cycle. Whereas in everywhere else in life, 5 years is a long time. You can graduate college in 4 years. You know? So how should one think about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a great question because I think, you know, part of what you're hitting on is the idea that there's no objective or rather subjective perceptions of the same objective length of time vary greatly depending on the context, right? I mean, look, the way that I think about this is that, you know, it probably boils down a little bit to what's most important to us, right? You know, if we're thinking about, let me step back. In other words, many times with these sorts of decisions that take place that have consequences now and later, there's many laters, right? So if, you know, if I want to save more for, you know, a big trip in 5 years, like I can see something on the horizon, we want to do a big trip with our family in 5 years. It's not just that it's now and later. There's also like many other time points along the way, right? So like it also impacts what sort of travel I do next summer or don't do, right? But that doesn't take away from the fact that 5 years can still feel like a really long time. I do think, you know, one way to grapple with this is to bring some rewards into the present so as to allow for a longer period of patience, right? So, you know, I don't know. Look, I'm not a financial advisor. I just talk to them. But, you know, when you talk about 5 years feeling like a long period of time, I think part of what you're talking about is the idea that it's hard to be patient and wait. Because, like, and this goes back to what we were saying before, which is that those rewards are accruing for some later self. So is there a way to peel off some of those rewards earlier on? Is there a way to, you know, somehow reward myself for sticking with a plan? I don't know what that looks like. I think that's idiosyncratic for everybody. But I guess my point is, if 5 years feels like a long period of time, is there any way to make that period of time shorter by introducing some rewards earlier and at many points along the way to increase the chances that I stick with whatever the program is?
Yeah, I think part of it is education and understanding. Part of it is small wins along the way towards big wins. Sort of like when you're working out, you don't go from today to 5 years what you look like without seeing the improvement through time.
Exactly.
So I guess you, like you said, you try to shorten the time with some benefit so that you don't have to wait for the full period.
That's exactly right. That's great.
The other tendency that I've noticed, maybe you can comment on this, is this notion of the herd and either following the herd, or if you're not following the herd, you can easily reference the herd and that becomes your comparison. And then, you know, a lot of things that I talk about is oftentimes the herd isn't doing things, you know, the most efficient way. And so if you're comparing yourself to that, then you leave yourself the risk of doing the wrong thing at the wrong time. So how do you think about all that?
Yeah, the way I like to think about that is, you know, who comprises the herd, right? And are those, you know, is that herd made up of people who have the same values I have and who, you know, have lives in theory that look like the life that I want to have, right? Not to get too specific about it, right? But I think, especially when it comes to investing behavior based on herd mentality, it's really easy to get overly focused on the thing that's salient, which is that I see some information about some hot returns from somebody who's posted them. And this is a little like that hidden zero thing we're talking about before, which is that, what am I not seeing? Right. And I think it'd be so useful to say, all right, first off, what percent of the people in that group aren't having those sorts of returns? Secondly, What does this strategy look like and what's it going to continue to look like for somebody in that group? Is that somebody, do I see myself being just like them? Or does that look stressful to me to have to hold on to something for a really long time before it pays off again? But we don't tend to do those things because what's salient is the number and whatever has been fed to us, you know, algorithmically on whatever platform we're on, right?
Right. We know that awareness is just the first step to making better decisions. People also need to care. Do you have any observations about that and any advice you can share?
There's a great paper by Dan Bartels and Oleg Gorminsky at Chicago, and it's called To Know and to Care. And they basically say it's not enough to just know that we should save or that we should discount future rewards less, but we also have to care about the outcomes that befall our future selves. Because if we just care but don't know how to do something, that's not going to put us in a good situation. If we know but we don't care, that won't put ourselves in a good situation. And so I do think, you know, it's a little bit difficult to say, we'll just care more. You know, that doesn't work, right? But then you start thinking like, okay, well, does that apply to any other context in our lives? You know, if I said just care more about your spouse or care more about your kids, I don't know if that would do anything. But if I said, okay, step into their shoes, what would life be like if you were them? And you were being treated the way they're being treated, or the same outcomes that are happening to them would be happening to you. It's a little easier to imagine because I don't have to engage in as much mental simulation of some other outcome. But if I put myself in their shoes and I can say, well, what would it be like to happen to me? Well, if that's, you know, some decision down the line and it's impacting future me, I think then that can help us sort of think about not just knowing, but then caring as well, like you said.
And that goes to the point of it hitting you emotionally.
Yeah.
And exactly. You think about movies and the impact they have on people because they see themselves in the movie. I think about significant events in economic or financial markets history. Somebody who lived through the Great Depression, They never borrowed another penny. You know, so somebody who lived through a very challenging environment, you know, that changed them forever. And if it lasted a short period of time, it had less impact than if it lasted a long period of time.
That's exactly right.
And it's because it hits you and you feel it.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I guess a lot of this is about trying to emotionally stimulate, either by being closer to you know, that, or seeing it through other people's eyes. And just, I think the big takeaway that I have from this is learning about these biases, but also trying to find some emotional connection so it has an impact and it motivates you to take action.
I think you said that really well.
This has been great. I just wanted to close with, if you have any additional suggestions for people to become better investors or savers from a behavioral standpoint, anything else that we didn't cover?
I think one of the you know, if there's two or three things, it would be like, make anything that you can make automatic within reason, right? So the downside of making things automatic is that you've got to make sure that there's money in whatever pot something is being drawn from. And I would say set up your decision-making environment to make it as easy as possible to follow through with the decision that you want to follow through with. It's something that many of us probably know, but don't really like execute on. And that would be a good thing to consider.
And it is helpful to have somebody that you're accountable to.
Yeah.
So a lot of times, you know, if you're on an institution and on your board and you have an investment policy and you set the rules, you're accountable to that investment policy and you're less likely to act on your emotions.
That's right.
If you have a spouse that is watching you like a hawk, you're more accountable, or an advisor that you have to talk to. That, I guess, effectively removes the impact that emotions have on the decision-making process.
That's right.
Helps with the education part. And when you put it all together, hopefully you make better decisions over time.
Exactly. That's great. Yeah.
Al, this has been fascinating. I enjoyed our conversation. I feel like I learned a lot, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks so much, Alex. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Please visit our website at insightfulinvestor.org to access past shows and learn more about our podcast. If you have questions, feel free to email us at info@insightfulinvestor.org. And if you enjoyed the discussion, please subscribe to this podcast to ensure you don't miss future episodes. And don't forget to forward today's conversation to others you think would enjoy listening. This podcast is provided for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Evoke Advisors, their affiliates, or companies featured. Due to industry regulations, participants on this podcast are instructed not to make specific trade recommendations, nor reference past or potential profits. And listeners are reminded that securities trading, commodity trading, and alternative investments are complex and carry a risk of substantial losses. As such, they are not suitable for all investors. Listeners should be aware that guests featured on The Insightful Investor may have current or past associations with Evoke Advisors or the host, including as an investment manager of a private fund opportunity by Evoke, or access through an affiliated Evoke fund, or as a client. Participation as a guest on the podcast should not be perceived as an endorsement or testimonial with respect to Evoke Advisors, the podcast host, or their services. Similarly, the inclusion of a guest on the podcast does not imply that Evoke Advisors or the host endorses the guest or any company with which they may be affiliated or employed. Evoke has neither paid nor received compensation from guests for their participation.